Hello, and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 340, Interview with Chris Berman. Author and lecturer Chris Berman is a graduate of Norwich University with an MA in military history and one of the leading experts on women combat pilots of World War II. He has written and lectured on cultural perceptions of warfare, pre-dreadnought battleships, combat on the Eastern Front, specifically Kursk and Stalingrad, and other related topics. One of his books is A White Star in a Red Sky, and he has written articles on the Night Witches, the female Soviet pilots who brought misery to the invading German soldiers, the main topic of this episode. Mr. Berman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Sure. So let's introduce you to the listeners. What influenced you to become a military historian?
Well, I'd always been interested in military technology, tactics, etc. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, I began writing and publishing military science fiction.
Right.
It was around a little later, my wife said to me, you know, you should really think about getting a master's degree in military history. And I said, okay.
That's a supportive wife.
So I got a degree in military history from Norwich University, which is the oldest private military school. Began in 1826.
Did not know that. Cool.
And what's interesting about that is they offer their MA in military history as an online course. So you could take it online and then you have to go up and spend like 2 weeks up at the university.
Right. I'll talk to my wife.
Okay. it's very interesting because you go into the details and the nuances of, different military campaigns. You study the differences between the Western way of war, the Eastern way of war,
right?
How warfare actually evolved from the ancient Greeks and the idea of the citizen soldier that started in Greece, more than 2,000 years ago,
right.
How that evolved into an actual professional army that the Romans had, the Roman legions. Mm-hmm. They were the world's first professional soldiers.
So you've taken all of this that you've learned and you've woven it into your stories, I'm guessing.
Pretty much. When I started my courses in military history, I got a lot of criticism on my writing because they said, well, you put in too much prose. You write like a fiction author. And I said, well, I am a fiction author. So right. It took some work to sort of whittle things down to become academic, academic work. And at the end of, the end of your master's course, you of course have to come up with a thesis. Mm-hmm. And it's like a PhD thesis.
Right.
And although it's not quite as thick as a PhD thesis, but it's close.
Right.
So I'm doing some research on some different topics. I was thinking first about the Battle of Actonon, where Cleopatra and Mark Antony were defeated by the Romans. And it was kind of like an idea like, well, don't let your girlfriend run the army because it doesn't end well.
Right. Right.
But then I was doing some research from one of the courses on gender in the military, and I was looking at the records of the women combat pilots of the USSR in World War II. And I said, wow, that's really interesting because there's no data from other standing militaries of large numbers of, female combatants.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed something really odd that the records of the women bomber pilots were exceptional. Mm-hmm. They were really good pilots. They had scored multiple hits on enemy targets. And then I noticed that the women fighter pilots, while, you know, some of them were pretty competent pilots, none of them had the sort of like the success of their male counterparts. And I was wondering, why is that? Right. There's some type of discrepancy there. So that became the basis of the thesis. And it really worked through the whole process of there's a whole difference in combat between the perceptions between a male brain and a female brain.
Oh.
They actually process information differently.
Cool. And that, like, gave the female pilots advantages on the Eastern Front?
It gave them advantages as bomber pilots because women can multitask under high levels of stress better than men can. Men, on the other hand, work better in a three-dimensional, a very free-flowing, three-dimensional environment, which would be like the fighter pilot.
Oh, dogfight.
You would think that bombers would be in a three-dimensional, envelope.
Right.
But they're really not. They're constrained to a tight formation, and you can't vary that formation. Now, you're in a bomber. Mm-hmm. You're being shot at from the ground. You're going to be attacked by aircraft, fighter aircraft, and you're trying to locate and hit your target.
Right.
And that's multitasking under extreme stress. Yeah. And it turned out that the regiments that were run by the women pilots, bombardiers, and navigators, etc., were exceptionally good at finding their targets and destroying their targets.
Right.
But there were a couple of very exceptional women fighter pilots. One of them was Lydia Litviak, who had scored 12 victories in three shared, and Katya Budanova, who had 11 victories. Both of them were killed in action.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that's why I wanted you to come onto the show, because I have four daughters and I'm always looking for positive female role models, you know, strength, courage, you know, determination, that kind of thing. And so when I had read that you wrote about that, I wanted to bring you on. And I'm just trying to imagine for a second, you know, it's let's just say it's the fall of 1941, the Germans have come into the Soviet Union. They're taking hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of prisoners. Stalin has got to do something. And I thought it was very wise of him not to ignore literally half of his population. You know, as we're going to go into a little later, the Japanese did very little with their the women of their country. The Americans and the British had limited roles for what they could do. But Stalin, Stalin is like, he sees an opportunity here, and he is in a desperate situation.
Well, yeah, the Red Air Force had lost, I think it was 41 or 4,200 aircraft within the first 2 weeks of the invasion.
Oh,
most of their aircraft were destroyed on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the ones that got into the air, I mean, they had their aircraft at that time were quite inferior to what the Germans were putting out, which were the Me-109s.
Right.
The Russians were flying the MiG-1, MiG-3, and the PO-15, which were vastly inferior to the German aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And their tactics were terrible, too. They were using World War I tactics, which they call it the Luftwaffe circle. The aircraft would kind of group up and form a defensive circle. Well, that might have worked with 100-mile-an-hour fighter planes in World War I, but they certainly didn't work with 350-mile-an-hour Messerschmitts, and they would just cut to pieces.
Right.
So they had a shortage of aircraft. And more importantly, they had a shortage of pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in October of 1941 that Marina Raskova, who was sort of like a Russian Amelia Earhart. She was decorated for her experimental flights and long distance flights, etc. She went to Stalin and said, "Look, we have thousands of women pilots,
mm-hmm.
and we should utilize them." So Stalin granted her three regiments, the 586th, which was a fighter regiment,
mm-hmm.
The 587th, which was a bomber regiment, and the 588th, which is the night bombers, which became known as the night witches.
Right.
And the women that flew in these these aircraft. Mm-hmm. These were girls. These were 17, 18, 19-year-old women.
Wow.
They had learned to fly in flying clubs, etc.
Right.
Lydia Litviak, who became an exceptional fighter pilot, learned to fly at age 15. And it turned out she wanted to fly with in the fighter regiment. They told her she didn't have enough hours. She had only had 50 hours. So she went back. She went back and drew a 1 in front of the 50 on her flight card and came back to somebody else and said, oh, yeah, I have 150 hours of flying time.
Right. She wanted to help. She wanted to contribute to the war effort.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. 15. Well, she can only have so many hours because she's 15, 16 years old. I mean, that's just mathematics.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So I'm glad you brought that up because so not only is, Western Russia being gobbled up by the Germans, Stalin needs everybody can get all hands on deck. They're dealing with these antiquated planes. But I remember something that you wrote during the purges. I think some of the engineers and designers of planes were, some of them were killed as well. So you're right. They're dealing with very old planes. Stalin, it's not like he's got a ton of planes to give to these women as well. So yeah, they're going to develop 3 regiments, but they're certainly not going to get the cream of the crop when they start to engage the enemy.
Well, they did have one fighter plane at that time that was being developed, the Yak-1,
right,
which could go toe to toe with an Me-109.
Oh, nice.
There weren't a lot of them, right, but they developed them. There was a whole series of them. And by the time the war, by the time they were into like, I think in 1944,
yeah,
the Yak-3 could outmaneuver, outfly, and had a higher top speed than any of the German fighter aircraft at the time.
I'm guessing the Soviets did not get credit for building a superior plane, because yeah, that it's kind of the same story with the T-34 tanks. I mean, the Germans just would not acknowledge how good they were, and I guess it's just a part of national pride and it doesn't fit the narrative. So it's good to know that the Soviets had something, but again, for right now, like you said, they have to make up the losses of thousands of planes of the first couple of weeks of Barbarossa.
Yeah, and then they got a lot of aircraft from the West. We supplied the Soviets with P-40s, mm-hmm, but we supplied them with 4,800 P-39 air Cobras.
Oh wow! Okay.
And the Russians loved the air Cobra. It was the perfect aircraft for the battlefront that they engaged in, where most of the air battles took place below 15,000 feet.
Right.
The Cobra was not well liked by U.S. or British flyers because it did not have a second stage supercharger.
Mm-hmm.
So once the plane hit 18,000 feet or so, it was easy meat for particularly for Japanese Zeros.
Yeah, so just another element of the technology that is necessary for warfare. Like you were mentioning earlier, the evolution of warfare and the equipment and weapons from 2,000 years ago. But going back to the Soviet female pilots, their 3 regiments, I'm hoping that you have some really great stories because I've read a little bit about the Night Witches, but anything that you wanted to share with us about any of those 3 regiments would be great because I really want people to get a sense of what the Germans, for all their early victories and for all the amazing success that they had and cutting off and surrounding and annihilating armies, when the sun went down, whenever the Night Witches get started, I know that things are going to change. And these German soldiers had to go through a lot of psychological abuse because these ladies were just tormenting them from the skies.
Yeah, the aircraft that they flew was a PO-2. It actually looked like a relic from the First World War. It was a cloth and wood biplane.
Right.
It had a top speed of about 95 miles an hour.
Wow.
But it carried a decent load of bombs under the wings.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the plane is they would take off from grass fields that were fairly close to the battlefront.
Right.
They would locate their target shut their engines off and glide in over the target. Because, I mean, these were slow-flying biplanes with big wings that made excellent gliders. So they'd glide in over the targets silently, drop their bombs, and then fire up their engines and get out of there.
Oh, my, the courage. The courage involved in, and one, turning off your engine. Two, after you drop your bombs and you start up your engines, you know the Germans are going to be shooting at you from the ground with their impressive
weaponry. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
They had the 588th, which was the 588th Regiment, was elevated to the 46th Guards Regiment, which meant that they became they were elevated in terms of prestige within the Red Air Force.
Right.
Of their pilots, they lost one out of every three pilots.
Oh, wow. So there were, I mean, so for all their bravery, courage, and dedication, they did suffer high losses because of coming so close to the enemy units.
Yeah, and then the Germans started putting up ME-110 night fighters to try to take them out. One of the pilots, being chased by a Messerschmitt, actually made the plane fly into a building because she brought the plane right down maybe 10 feet over a street in a little town.
Mm-hmm.
And the ME-110 is trying to chase her down and flies right into a building. And that's the end of him.
Right. That's incredible. So literally using what they have to the best of their ability. Because
slow speed and maneuverability actually became an advantage when they were being chased by, you know, high powered fighter aircraft.
Oh my goodness! Because, and I think you said this a couple of minutes ago. I mean, this is a wooden frame with canvas, 115 horsepower, 5-cylinder engine. I mean, it doesn't have a lot to recommend itself. But if you know, anything can be used as a weapon if you figure out how to do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it even had advantages where planes that were all metal or aluminum wing, et cetera, if they had gotten hit with some of the anti-aircraft fire, it would have taken out the aircraft. In the case of the PO-2, a lot of those shells just passed harmlessly through the canvas wings.
Oh, yeah. What does it matter? It's just a hole in the canvas as long as the engine is fine. That's incredible. Now, I was staggered by the number of missions. Can you tell us? I mean, like you were saying, the ladies of the 588th, they didn't fly just a few. I mean, obviously, the Germans, you know, 3 million Germans and their allies coming into Russia, these ladies had to fly a lot of missions to try to stem that tide of the invasion.
Yeah, well, with the Red Air Force, it was different than like the Allied Air Forces. You know, like for the American bombers, they'd run 20 missions and then you'd be rotated out of there.
Right.
In the USSR, you flew your missions until you were either killed or the war was over.
Because it's a matter of necessity. It's, life or death, I guess.
Yeah, some of those women flew 800 missions.
I cannot comprehend. Did they lose count at some point? I'm sure someone's keeping a record, but how numb would you be after the 700th mission? I mean, and every night, I guess you're assuming, tonight could be the night that I die. And you go in.
Yeah. And sometimes, well, particularly when they had good dark cover.
Right.
Sometimes they flew 18 sorties. One pilot would fly 18 sorties in a night. Her and her navigator.
Right. So they would bomb, go back, get more bombs, go back.
Go back again, drop more bombs. Exactly. They were just like, it was kind of like an assembly line of bombing the Germans.
Oh, my goodness. Please.
It had terrible psychological effect on the German troops because, they couldn't relax. They couldn't sleep. You know, every 20, 30 minutes – these silent aircraft would be coming over their positions and dropping bombs on them.
If I could just stop you for a second, I'm just trying to imagine being a German soldier, and it's not like you can listen out for the plane because, like you said, they cut their engines or maybe you hear the planes and then the engine noise fades away. I mean, how devastating would it be to have a bomb dropped near you with practically no warning? I mean, I imagine their nights were absolutely horrific because of the night witches.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. So if you have any other stories about any of the Soviet pilots, please feel free to share. But I did want to ask you if you can compare their experiences with the women in the United States or Great Britain. What did you find as far as differences there?
Well, our pilots, our women pilots, we started with the Women's Auxiliary Ferrying Service, which right. were young women that would fly with, you know, they were obviously capable flyers. Mm-hmm. They would take the aircraft from the factories and fly them to forward bases where, you know, pilots would then pick them up and then right. Fly them to combat areas. Mm-hmm. And We had a lot of very competent women pilots. We lost, I believe it was 36 of them during the war, but those were to mechanical failure, weather conditions, et cetera. Right. Right. The British also had a similar service where they had women pilots delivering Spitfires and Hurricanes to forward bases.
And I'm assuming in America, in the UK, there was probably flying clubs as well. So when the war starts, you've got women who've got a flying experience. But I guess now for America, it makes sense. It's not like we're being invaded and we're on the edge and we have to have everybody pitch in. So for whatever reason, America, the government decides to keep women as ferry pilots. UK, it's a little more intense with the Battle of Britain, but I guess they just for whatever reason decide you can help us, but it will only be so close to the front.
Right. They did also use women pilots for spotting U-boats.
Oh, that's right. Right.
And but not actually in combat roles.
Gotcha. Okay. And I guess that was just a decision of the powers that be at the time. I did find out because when I read that, I wanted to find out more about what maybe Germany or Japan did. Please add on to this if you have any information. I do know sure. that in the Empire of Japan, say from 1937 to 1943, the most that Japanese women were willing were allowed to do was volunteer associations. But once a woman was married, that was kind of it. She was expected to stay home and to, you know, take care of the house or the farm or whatever. But by 1943, mm-hmm. Japanese women were actually working in factories, obviously out of necessity. But again, right. once you're married and you're a certain age, you're removed from that. So a very different picture over there.
Although at the very end, before the Japanese surrendered, mm-hmm. The emperor had commanded everyone, women, children, old men,
right.
to pick up weapons and to fight to the death for an Allied invasion. And that's why at that time we kind of estimated like if we did a seaborne invasion of the Japanese islands, mm-hmm. we would probably lose about 2 million men.
Wow. And which is probably contributed to the idea of dropping the bomb, because to lose that many men, because I think total America lost around 500,000 troops altogether?
Yeah, actually a little less than that.
Okay.
I think it was around 380,000.
Okay.
And you compare that to Soviet losses, which were, sure. 15 to 20 million.
Right. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah. And in Germany, I think what factory work might have been the extent, but I'm certainly not an expert on that.
Yeah. Now, as far as I know, the Germans had limited use of women pilots, although they did have their one of their aeronautical researchers, mm-hmm. Hannah Reich,
right.
was instrumental in developing jet aircraft and also the V-1 rocket bomb.
Right. So let's kind of zoom out for a second. So we've been talking about the various female pilots of the countries, but like you were saying a couple of minutes ago, when it comes to the Soviet pilots, besides maybe the phrase night witches, there's not a lot that's known. That, like you were saying earlier, why do you think that is? That this is a very fascinating topic, and yet it's not maybe as prevalent or as known as it should be.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, not made by us.
Right.
A lot of history talks about D-Day as being, you know, the crucial battle of the turning of the tide against the Germans.
Right.
It was actually the Battle of Kursk in July of 1943 that broke the back of the German army.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time on, they kept being pushed back further and further, first through Poland and then all the way back into Germany.
Right.
You know, but of course they're being squeezed from two sides. It becomes a two-front war,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, military tacticians say you should never fight a two-front war because you're in deep trouble.
Yes.
I mean, we did in the United States, but we were fortunate to be separated by the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. So we never actually had any, we never had bombers flying over our industrial complex and taking out our production capabilities.
Yeah, we had the two greatest moats on the planet.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, go ahead.
But
please.
You wanted me to mention something interesting about one of the other pilots.
Yes, please.
Lydia Litviak. Had actually, there was a story that she had shot down in the Battle of Stalingrad. She had shot down a German ace.
Right.
And he was captured by Soviet forces.
Oh, wow.
And he wanted to know, he, you know, because he had over 40 victories, and he wanted to know who was the man who was good enough to shoot me down.
What?
I want to meet this pilot.
Shake his hand.
And,
yeah.
You know, it was kind of an inside joke with the Soviets. Yeah, okay, I'll let you meet the pilot. So this little, you know, 19-year-old girl,
right.
She stood about 5'2" and weighed about 110 pounds. She came in, you know, and, you know, to tell him she shot you down.
Yeah.
And he just would not believe it until she described the air battle to him,
right.
You know, in detail, all his maneuvers and her maneuvers. She's, yeah, I shot you down.
Ooh, so much for machoism. And I would have given anything to have been a fly on the wall at that moment. That's incredible. Oh, if I could real quick, you mentioned D-Day, and I did not know this until I was getting ready to talk to you. I didn't realize that Martha Gellhorn, who was an American journalist, novelist, and travel writer, she actually went ashore on D-Day. Let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, so she wanted to witness the Normandy landings, and she hid in mm-hmm. a hospital ship in the bathroom, and she pretended to be a stretcher bearer to gain access to the beach. So she was the only woman to land at Normandy on D-Day, and I just thought that was incredible. Of course, after that, soon the following year, she's going to be one of the first to go into the Dachau concentration camp. So at one
sure.
moment, it's an incredible high for her, and then the next moment, she's seeing the absolute worst that humans can do to each other.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Jeez. So we've kind of talked about the pilots from the various countries, but I wanted to switch gears, if I could, a little bit. Earlier, you mentioned some of the cultural perceptions of warfare, and I've got to ask, how does that differ from the various countries that were involved in World War II?
Well, this wasn't actually... It does have a tendency. You do have a tendency to see that in the conflict between the United States and our allies and the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese took on all the accoutrements of a Western military.
Right.
They built aircraft carriers, aircraft. They built a first-rate military machine,
mm-hmm.
but their internal philosophy, their war fighting philosophy, was still mired in older, different,
right.
You want to say different, more Eastern cultural perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Like the entire idea, we're appalled by the idea of a Japanese, we call them a sneak attack, like at Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But that was a particular ambush tactic
mm-hmm.
was considered that's a normal tactic.
It's valid.
The reason the Japanese even went that route is they basically were repeating what they did in 1908. The Japanese did a preemptive strike against the Russian fleet in Port Arthur in the on the Korean Peninsula and destroyed their ships in while they were at anchor.
Right.
Which drew out the entire Russian fleet into the Battle of Tsushima, and they sunk the entire Russian fleet except for two ships.
Right.
And they said, well, you know, if it worked in 1908, it should work now. So we attack the ships in Pearl Harbor. We draw out the American fleet at Midway, and we destroy it. But it didn't turn out that way.
I guess that does run counter to the, and I'm not saying that it's superior, but to the Western notion of fair fighting, honor, you know, being everybody's given a proper warning. Because if it's going to come down to war, I guess the Japanese were thinking victory is the most important thing. Don't bother me with the niceties. And I can semi-respect that. In one of my series, I'm covering Pappy Boyington from Baba Black Sheep. And when he first goes to Burma with the other American fighters, the AVG, the British find out what Chenault wants to do. He wants them to go up higher than the Japanese, dive down, shoot, go up again. You know, don't engage them because their planes are better than yours. So, and they've got years of experience. So if you just try to do a normal dogfight, you will die. So Chenault comes up with this idea. And when the British, some of the British flyers hear about this, well, they don't like that very much because it's ungentlemanly. But again, this is another example of where defeat equals death. And so you do what you have to do. And I guess that was the Japanese attitude or point of view.
Well, yeah, I suppose so, too. But, I mean, when you look at differences in cultural perception of warfare,
right.
One of the biggest examples of that was the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Spanish had this idea of their ships were you almost want to call them floating castles.
Right.
And the idea was these huge galleons would close in for battle. The ships would grapple, and then the combatants on the ships would fight each other, you know, with swords and spears and crossbows, like it was a land battle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the British at that time developed their ships completely different philosophy. They were low to the waterline, they were fast, and they were lined with a cannon of all the same caliber. And so when the Spanish come in to close for this sort of like land battle at the sea,
right.
The British stand off at a distance and just pummel them with cannon fire.
Right.
And the Spanish are appalled. They're yelling off their ships. What are you doing? You're cowards. You're women.
Right.
You should come here and fight us like men.
Oh, my goodness.
And they're just slaughtering them with chain shot and canister shot and solid shot. And it was a completely different cultural perception between the two combatant navies.
Yeah, that reminds me of something you said a little earlier. You know, you constantly change how you fight. You find better ways, like the Soviet female pilots were using the very thing that you would think would be a weakness in their planes, the slow speed, to an advantage. And how you fight is constantly changing. That reminds me of, you know, the beginning of World War II. A lot of people in the Navy still thought the battleship was the end-all, be-all of how you win. But certainly by the time it's all over with, it's the carriers that matter. And the battleships are nothing more than protection for those carriers because they could do so much more damage. So warfare, like everything else, I guess, constantly evolves.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
You know, it was like when the European knights went up against the Mongols in the 1240s.
Right.
They expected the Mongols to fight them the way knights would fight other knights.
Right.
And that's not what they did. They rode in on these horses. They were little horses. They were lightly armored.
Mm-hmm.
And they just rained arrows down on the European knights.
Right.
And when the European knights went out to fight them in the field, they surrounded them and killed them all.
Wow.
Without any challenge of battle or anything like that. So that, you know, yeah, it was a completely different philosophy of warfare.
Right. I don't mean to make too light of it, but yeah, like you were saying a couple of minutes ago, you can't really complain, hey, you're not killing me the proper way. Do it the right way. I mean, victory is victory, whether it's the British ships or the arrows, you know, guys on horseback shooting arrows, whatever works at the end of the day is what really matters.
Yeah, we did that in the American Revolution. The British came marching
right
in battle squares wearing these red uniforms.
Right.
And our guys are hiding behind stone walls. They're up in trees. They're wearing brown buckskins that camouflage them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as the British approach, there's no forming up of armies facing each other. They
right
just start shooting at them.
Oh, my goodness. Very ungentlemanly.
Yeah, well, that's what the British thought. This is you're not fighting us the proper way.
Right, things change. Oh, yeah. So, Chris, it's been great having you on the show, and I really do appreciate the insights into the Soviet pilots, because that was a lot more than I had read. So, I appreciate it. But before I let you go, I wanted to kind of circle back to your knowledge of military history and your writing as well. So, I imagine
right
you take a lot of what you have learned over the years and you incorporate that into your writing to make, even though it's fiction, it makes it that much more enjoyable, knowledgeable, and realistic.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. My
sure
new book, which was just released, it's titled A White Star in a Red Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting story. It's about an American WAFS pilot,
right,
who's bringing Lend-Lease P-39s to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
She'd found out earlier that her brother, younger brother in North Africa, had been executed by the SS.
Wow.
When they tried to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants more than anything to fly combat. And
right
at the base, the Russians come to pick up the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their pilots is a young woman pilot. She's also their translator.
Right.
They strike up a friendship together. And through a series of events that happens, she winds up taking the ninth plane into Russia.
Oh.
with the help of her friend. And she flies in the Battle of Kursk.
So she gets to fulfill her desire for revenge.
Yeah, she's an exceptional pilot too. And between the two of them, they shoot down a lot of Germans. they both survive being shot down themselves. They go through an extensive travel through the battlefield and
right
and come across an unexpected ally that turns out to be very helpful to them, a deserting German soldier.
Yeah, I wanted to let you know that I was looking through your website and your list of books. So when the holidays comes up and things kind of slow down, I'm looking forward to reading A White Star in a Red Sky and Ace of Aces, because I really loved that concept. So those would be two that I'm checking out.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And thank you for having me on your show. And,
absolutely.
And as far as White Star and a Red Sky, it's available now on Amazon and other venues.
I'm glad you said that, because that was my next question. Chris Berman, thank you very much for being on, and I hope the rest of your day is great.
Thank you.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.